Well, my gosh, you have gotten two presentations that should persuade you. I mean, why did we ever model something after Massachusetts, number one? And number two, you got a sense of the inadequacy. So the question is there an alternative? And so my task is to talk more about health reform if we went by single payer versus what we've gotten with PPACA. And as far as I know, I do not own any stock in a private health insurance company or a pharmaceutical company, so I don't think I have any financial conflicts, but it is important for you to know that I am president of Physicians for a National Health Program, but they give me no financial compensation. So what I thought I would do is start by just, you know, outlining the challenges facing us in the U.S. healthcare system, and then compare single payer with PPACA. So these are the seven fundamental challenges that I think we face. Declining access, escalating costs, defining what are real benefits, restricted choice, uneven quality, a lack of primary care, and how to pay for it all if we were to reform the system. In terms of single payer, what are we talking about? Well, I think in terms of the public, and it's important, and the reason I think this is part of our discussion is we've got to think about how we describe this to people, because there are so many myths and misconceptions about what we're talking about. And so we're talking about an improved, expanded Medicare for all, in spite of all of its problems, and my students tell me I should call it Medicare 2.0. And we're going to contrast that with the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, PPACA, which was passed on March 23rd, which frankly was not health care reform, right? It was really health insurance reform. So, starting with challenge one, declining access. And indeed, if you look from the 1970s to the present, virtually a million more uninsured every year, little dip here in the 1980s when we got an expansion of Medicaid, a little dip here at the end of the 90s when we got the state child health insurance program, and now this slide is way out of date because we are actually at 50.7 million uninsured. Well, how does an improved Medicare for all single payer program address these problems? I think the critical words are automatic enrollment. What happens in this country when you turn 65? You get a letter from Medicare. You are now enrolled, right? I mean, it's really amazing. So if Jonathan goes to the emergency room of a hospital under this plan, they do their wallet biopsy on him and find he has no health insurance, well, let's just sign him up right there. Right? That's the way. He should be automatically enrolled. Is there any private health insurance company that would sign you up when you present it to the emergency room of a hospital? No way. This is a real federal guarantee. We did not get that with PPACA, and it should cover all residents of the United States. That means, in fact, even those who are undocumented, right? We could then put into the legislation some restriction so people didn't just come here. You know, you have to be a resident for 6 months or 9 months or a year. And as you know, our mantra is everybody in, nobody out. Well, how did PPACA address this? Well, by mandating the purchase of private health insurance in 2014. Expanding Medicaid eligibility, a good thing, no question about it. And you can see here what the 133% of poverty level would be. Subsidizing premiums up to 400% of the poverty level, that would be these numbers here. And as Len pointed out, the question is, how adequate will those subsidies be? And yes, a whole basket of good market reforms in health insurance. You know, guaranteed issue, no pre-existing condition exclusions, only to start in 2014. No rescissions, a private insurance company can't take away the insurance that they gave you because they suddenly discovered that, you know, you had some condition that you didn't report to them that you might not even have known that you had, and no annual lifetime or lifetime limits. Good things, okay? But as Len pointed out to you, you know, even the Congressional Budget Office said there will be 23 million uninsured people by 2019. This was not a universal coverage bill, let's face it. Well, what about costs? You've heard a lot about that, so maybe we don't need to dilate too much on it. And indeed, if you look at this, over the last decade, health insurance premiums went up 119% at the same time as workers' earnings went up only 34%, and inflation took away a lot of that at 29%. Little wonder that during this period, the major reason that a union went on strike was because the employer was trying to shift the cost of premiums onto the employee. And indeed, Len pointed these numbers out to you. Employer-provided health insurance, that's the cheapest insurance you can get because they can negotiate with the insurer. And it's up to close to $14,000 for family coverage. Well, how does an improved Medicare for All address the cost problem? Well, largely by dealing with low administrative costs. We look at Medicare as a program. Of all of the premiums and dollars collected through payroll taxes for the Medicare program, essentially 97 to 98% go to pay doctors and hospitals. Only 2 to 3% stays there for the bureaucracy. In contrast to private health insurance, which keeps roughly 16 to 30% of the premium dollars they collect. In this article in the New England Journal of Medicine, it is estimated that if we went from our multi-payer system to a single-payer system, we could save $400 billion, redirect that to cover everyone who's uninsured and to expand coverage for those who are underinsured. And where does that money come from? This is a study actually done by the Lewin Group, owned presently by United Healthcare. And what they show is indeed it costs more to cover the uninsured and the poorly insured. It costs more if you're going to eliminate cost sharing and co-pays, deductibles, things like that. But you can save money not only in insurance overhead, but also in hospital overhead. We did a comparison of Toronto General with the Mass General. Three billers at Toronto General, 300 billers at the Mass General. In my office, I could save money because I need to have that extra staff, you know, that deals with the 25 different insurance companies that I face, right? We could begin to bulk purchase, you know, drugs the way the VA does and get lower prices, and we could really talk about a good emphasis on primary care. In essence, we could save money by moving to a single-payer program. This illustrates that savings. Here are the number of doctors, right? And this is the number of administrators. Oh my gosh, we need to amputate that group, give them meaningful work instead of pushing papers and denying claims. You know, let's retrain them to do meaningful work in healthcare. And indeed, our bill talks about that retraining. And just to show that this overhead number of 3% in Medicare isn't made up by me, this is from Carl Schramm, a conservative economist. You can tell he was conservative because the average commercial insurer overhead is 19.9%. He wouldn't say 20%. And if a nonprofit blue converts to a for-profit blue, its administrative costs go up. And in addition to that, single payer offers real tools to contain costs. Global budgeting of hospitals, capital investment planning, an emphasis on primary care and the coordination of care, and alternative ways of paying for care, and as I've mentioned, bulk purchasing of pharmaceuticals. Well, how does PPACA control costs? The major way is that it controls the cost of the premium. Why? How? Well, by mandating penalties for those who are uninsured. The whole idea was, let's force those young invincibles, right, who are well and have low risks into the insurance risk pool. And presumably, you'd be able to reduce premiums, right? Because they cost, they'll be contributing more than they cost. And so you have this individual mandate, and you have even an employer mandate in PPACA for those employers that have more than 50 employees, right? But, you know, look at this kind of cost. In 2016, a family will have to pay $2,000 or so if they don't get health insurance, but I just told you you couldn't buy it for less than $13,000. Is this going to work? Is this in fact going to force people to buy insurance? You know, I don't see how it's going to work. And what about the employer? Okay, again, a $13,000 premium. Let's go individual, $5,000, $6,000. But the fine is only going to be $2,000. So I don't know that this is going to mandate that many people to buy health insurance. And the real problem, as Len pointed out, it leaves many of the undesirable features of employment-based health insurance unchanged. Employers can change coverage and plans anytime they want, every year that they want. I can be in your plan this year, and then I'm out next year, right? So you can't see me anymore, right? Insurers can change the provider networks, right? And employees must accept the employer's plan. Otherwise, they pay those fines. And frankly, PPACA really offers pretty unproven tools to contain costs. Health insurance, health information technology, a great thing. We need more of it, but it's going to cost a lot of money to get our clinicians and our hospitals, which, you know, right now it's estimated about 10 to 15% of doctors in private practice and hospitals have really fully functional HIT. Chronic disease management, great thing to have, but I bet you it's going to cost a little bit more to put it into place. And these medical homes, yeah, also nice, but I think they're in fact going to cost us more. And sure enough, what Len showed you is that you know, by 2019, we're going to be spending 21% of our gross domestic product on healthcare. PPACA does not control costs. Single payer Medicare for all at least has the promise, and I think the reality, that we could control costs. Well, what about benefits? You know, there are two kinds of benefits to keep in mind. Service coverage, doctors, nurse practitioners, RXs, you know, prescription drugs, are those things covered? And then there's financial coverage, co-pays and deductibles. What does Medicare for All promise? Well, we would have to struggle for this, but I think we really don't want a basic plan. We want a comprehensive plan, one that covers everything from preventive services down to reproductive and nursing home care, all medically necessary services. Any exclusions? Yeah, sure. Tummy tucks, Botox for wrinkles. Okay. Even private rooms in the hospital. I'm in a room with Walter over there, and he's coughing away, and the resident comes in and says, "Oh, Walter, I think you might have tuberculosis. Get me out of his room. He has a medically necessary reason for a private room." How would these things be decided? Complex question. We can deal with that in the question period. How does an improved Medicare for All deal again with this issue, co-pays and deductibles? I think we should just get rid of them. Every study that's been done show that they reduce needed and unneeded care equally. We need to really have the use, and what these co-pays and deductibles do is that they really lead to an underuse of primary care services. Frankly, they're not as effective even in reducing the overuse of expensive technology. If we eliminated self-referral to doctor-owned facilities, we'd do better. If we reduced defensive medicine, we would do better. What does PPACA do? Well, there's no standard benefit package. It mandates coverage of checkups and other preventive services. Good, that it should do. Reduces or eliminates co-pays and deductibles, but only on preventive services, not even on primary care services. Restricted choice. You all know that 42% of employees have no choice. Why is that? Because the employer offers only one plan, right? And frankly, private insurance overall limits our choice because it makes us pay more if we go outside the network that the insurer has negotiated contracts with. How does PPACA deal with that? It just expands choice, right? There should be no limit to a provider network. There should be and would be free choice of doctor and hospital. And finally, we would be able to de-link health insurance from a person's employment. In PPACA, the way it's dealt with is essentially with these state exchanges. And as you know, you get a real reduction in benefits in terms of abortion services. Quality, we were 19 among, we last among 19 industrialized nations in mortality amenable to health care. And we've gotten worse since 2009, 2006. What would improved Medicare for All do? Well, frankly, we would have a national database on which to begin to measure quality. One of the real problems today is that private insurers call their databases proprietary. No little wonder that all the studies that have been done are on Medicare data when you look at the comparisons. We could get national standards, public reporting, HIT for the nation. With patient protections, every patient should be able to have their medical record on a little, credit card-like thing. PPACA promises some interesting things: comparative effectiveness research, an innovation center. We heard a lot about that this afternoon in CMS. Value-based purchasing, readmission penalties, reduce payments to hospitals for hospital-acquired conditions. Probably good things overall if implemented appropriately. The lack of primary care, not going to deal very, very quickly with this. In an improved Medicare for All, we would argue for debt forgiveness for students that go into primary care, malpractice payment at least for primary care providers, if not for everybody who participates in the program, and yes, the real implementation of patient-centered medical homes. PPACA essentially provides a 10% primary care bonus payment. We calculated that for E&M services, evaluation and management's about $5 per visit. Increased Medicaid payment to Medicare rates, that probably in many states is quite significant. And this independent payment advisory board which we really don't know the shape of. And finally, how do you pay for all this reform? In Medicare for All, you do it with public funding. That's the crucial thing. Using either a combination of payroll taxes, corporate taxes, and income taxes, but the elimination of premium payments. Premiums are ultimately really very unfair because the president of the company pays the same premium as the secretary in the company. And indeed, we're talking about a nonprofit private delivery system under local control. Doctors would not be salaried by government. Hospitals would not be owned by government. This is not socialized medicine. It is publicly funded, privately delivered partnership. And PPACA, how is it going to be financed? This whole notion of an excise on Cadillac health insurance plans. What is a Cadillac health insurance plan? It's a good plan, right? It's the kind that you want to have, right? An increase in the Medicare payroll tax on people with high incomes, and actually a very interesting thing that is not bad, a tax on investment income, unearned income. That's not happened recently. And then the savings from Medicare that really have drive seniors a little bit crazy. So, in summary, what do we get with healthcare reform? An expanded coverage, but not universal. Cost control by market means only, that's going to fail. No definition, really, of benefits. Choice through state-based exchanges, but no public option, and limited, really, to those who were previously uninsured. Limits on abortion, primary care and quality pilots, and funding through excise taxes and cuts on Medicare. What do you get if you get single payer? This is in our physician's proposal in JAMA. Universal coverage with automatic enrollment, low administrative costs because it's single payer, comprehensive coverage without copays and deductibles, maximum choice of doctor, nurse practitioner, and hospital, improved quality through nationwide HIT, expanded primary care, and publicly funded but privately delivered. This is Medicare 2.0. And we've got the bill in Congress that's going to be reintroduced. H.R. 676 has 86 co-sponsors now and probably will when it's reintroduced. And the similar bill, Senate 703. So in conclusion, finally, a system based on private health insurance plans will not lead to universal coverage, will not create affordable health insurance. A Medicare for All system can lead to universal, comprehensive coverage without costing more and has the greatest potential to increase choice, improve quality, and expand primary care, and it can be financed fairly. For more information, really go to our national website, and here are a few articles and books that you could get if you wanted to dig deeper. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Ollie. Sarah and I think we should consider Botox in that list of services after all. Let's see. Martha Livingston is our last speaker. Martha's a professor of health and society at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. She was the recipient of the 2003 Chancellor's Award for Excellence in Teaching. She's vice chair of the board of directors of the New York Metro Chapter of Physicians for National Health Program, and she's lived in Canada for a number of years ago, so she's familiar with the Canadian healthcare system.
Thanks, Karen. So let me ask you something. Are you pissed off yet? I can't hear you. Are you pissed off yet? Thank you. So my talk's title is a bit of a misnomer. I called it How Long, Not Long. Remember when Martin Luther King used to say that? How long, not long, right? Well, actually, this talk needs to be called How Long, Too Damn Long. We've heard in great detail exactly what's wrong with PPACA, what would be right with single payer. Now I'm going to give you Andy Borowitz's version, which was called compromise care. He said, Senate unveils compromise care. People remember this from last year? Washington, the Borowitz report. The United States Senate today unveiled details of its health care plan, tentatively called compromise care TM. Under compromise care TM, people with no coverage will be allowed to keep their current plan. Medicare will be extended to 55-year-olds just as soon as they turn 65. You'll have access to cheap Canadian drugs if you live in Canada. States whose names begin with vowels will be allowed to opt out of the plan. You get to choose which doctor you cannot afford to see. You will not have to be pre-certified to qualify for cremation. A patient will be considered pre-existing if he or she already exists. You'll be free to choose between medications and heating fuel. Patients can access quality health care if they can prove their name is Lieberman. That, of course, is about Senator Lieberman. You will have access to natural remedies, such as death. And finally, you are at liberty to move to France for the best health care in the world. So you've heard all the reasons to support single payer. I want to boil them down to three kinds of arguments. The first, which you've heard a lot about, is the economic argument. Single payer is the only one that wrests money out of the for-profit industry and puts it into actual health care. The public health argument, which I don't have to sell to anybody in this room, we understand that the public needs health. We'll move along. Finally, and the most powerful argument, as far as I'm concerned, is the moral argument. It's truly disgusting that in the richest country in the world, not everybody can get health care when they need it, for crying out loud. What is the matter with us? What kind of country do we live in where firefighters go to a guy's house and stand there and watch it burn down because he didn't pay his $75 fee? This is exactly analogous to what's going on in healthcare, and it's absolutely immoral and disgusting. The healthcare justice movement, broadly defined over the past year and a half, and not including those groups who really stayed with single payer, made one tragic flaw, and that was in negotiating with themselves. Choosing what I call a surrogate endpoint, the public option, which somehow, by some magic, was going to compete on some mythical level playing field with for-profit insurance companies that know really well how to avoid actually covering sick people. I don't know if you saw an article in the October 20th New York Times, insurers try new payment systems for cancer care. Just when you thought it wasn't going to get any uglier, I'm just going to give you a brief quotation. Dr. Lee Newcomer, the oncologist who is heading the United Healthcare program, said that yearly double-digit increases in the cost of cancer care had forced insurers to confront the issue. Oncology, or cancer care, has been a bit of a sacred cow, he said. Well, I really want, if anybody I love is confronted with a life-threatening illness, to have the decision about the specifics of treatment to be made by my insurance company, don't you? We in the single-payer movement are also really sick of hearing that PPACA is far from perfect, but a step in the right direction, because we don't think that's necessarily so. You've heard some of the arguments about how it may very well actually further entrench the for-profit insurance industry, giving them a central role and even more power than they already had. And finally, what really sucked worse almost than anything else in the past year was that we got boxed into a corner where we were not supposed to be critical of what was going down in Washington, because any criticism of this plan was going to give aid and comfort to the enemy, the Republicans, who wanted to see no health care reform whatsoever. This is not the way politics works, folk. Shut up and go home has never been a really good strategy for getting what we need, not only in health care, but in any avenue of political activity. Anybody in this room remember? I'm going to call their names. Franklin McCain, Joseph McNeil, Ezell Blair Jr., and David Richmond. Raise your hand if you ever heard those names. You did hear those names before. Because in Greensboro, North Carolina, in 1960, 50 years ago, those four college students sat down at a lunch counter in Woolworths and changed the world. They weren't playing politics as usual. They were told by parents, by pastors, by teachers, by college administrators that this was really not a good idea. This wasn't playing by the rules. They were going to get expelled from school. Their futures were going to be ruined. And if they just went along and played by the rules and just took things a little more slowly, why, maybe eventually, somehow, some change, as Sam Cooke would have said, was going to come. Well, they didn't listen, did they? And you may not remember their names, but the minute I told you who they were, you remembered who they were. I got to meet three of them, the three surviving ones, this year at the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. It's not that I'm opposed to our participating in two-party politics, but I do want to remind you of an old saying that Republicans will hang you from a high tree and Democrats will hang you from a low tree. So what we really need to do is move away from that kind of you've got no place else to go, so you've got to play the politics that they want you to play. Again, that's not how to make change. Remember what Cornel West said on Sunday, when he was highly critical of, as he puts it, Brother Obama, right? He said, love means connecting, respecting to correcting. I love that line. It is not our job as single payer advocates, as healthcare justice advocates, to sell PPACA to the American people. It's our job to overthrow it and get the real kind of healthcare that we need. What will we be doing in the next few years? Single-payer advocates sitting on the sidelines booing PPACA? Hardly. We're going to be just like Tom Joad. Remember Tom Joad? Remember the end of that movie? Wherever we can build a single-payer program in a state, wherever an insurance company is trying to ooze out of paying for needed care, wherever a hospital is threatened, wherever healthcare workers are picketing, wherever our people are suffering, wherever there's a struggle for healthcare justice, we'll be there. Remember what Frederick Douglass taught us. He didn't say power concedes nothing without a request. He said power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will, and we need to keep on demanding healthcare justice till we get it. Thank you very much.
Martha, so questions. Want to breathe for a minute? Yes.
I'm kind of a skeptic. I think we may be too kind to be PPACA. I think the cost control in there actually might work. I mean, there. Obviously, there's just huge amounts of money that's being given to drug companies, that's being given to the insurers. But if you look at what they're planning to take away from Medicare, it is really very money away from those nasty, nasty Medicare Advantage plans, that's only a quarter of the amount of money that's being taken away. This commission.
Do you want to just turn sideways so people can hear in the back too?
Oh, yeah. This commission, that's the payment commission, has incredible powers. I mean, if the per person cost of Medicare goes up from 1 year to the next faster than a threshold, and the threshold is tied to the cost of living, if it goes up faster than that, it proposes cuts which Congress has to overcome by a three-fifths majority in both houses to prevent it from coming into effect. And it only stops it if Congress proposes its own cuts at the same amount. I think there's dangers of very bad cuts to Medicare through this plan.
Okay. Does anybody want to comment on that? Len?
Just the danger to Medicare is immediate. It's in this commission that is due to report December 1st that was set up by the president and stacked with anti-social program congressmen and advocates. So that, you know, the issue, we're going to face the issue in the next few weeks about in terms of defending both Social Security and Medicare, and everybody should be alert for that. There's a lot of advocacy and action you're going to hear about in the next few weeks when that starts to come out.
Not on that, okay. Other, yes?
Is it possible for the panelists to suggest action? What is needed now? How do we get speakers out to medical schools, graduate schools, public health programs, and so on, to enlist in a larger movement to deal with the issue?
Yeah, no, I think that all you have to do is just go to our website, and we'll be glad to send speakers to not just medical schools, but to unions, to church groups, to community groups. We just held our leadership training program and speakers training program, and over 100 people attended that. So I think we've got people that can go out. A more immediate thing is actually that I think we've got to think about how to respond to this deficit commission report on, you know, December 1st. We are thinking and strategizing about whether or not this is another time that some meaningful civil disobedience or other things should be done to truly highlight this issue. So stay tuned around that. That's going to come up very, very soon. Otherwise, we are actively actually writing to residency programs, writing to medical schools to be able to present this information. It's really important. I wanted to just mention while I have the opportunity, after this session at 6:30, the medical care section will be holding its evening with session. And during that session, there will be our Vissel Tier Award to Dr. Susan Reverby, who, as many of you know, did the historical work on the Tuskegee study, but most recently, actually, was highly publicized because of her revelation of the CDC's involvement, actually, in injecting spirochetes, syphilis germs, into spinal fluid of Guatemalan citizens. Really disturbing. And in addition to that, Donna Smith, who some of you may know from SICO, the woman who moved into Denver because she lost her house, essentially, paying for medical care bills, and has now become an active organizer for the National Nurses Union, will be talking about her experiences. So come join us at 6:30. It should be a great session.
Let me comment, too, on
Can I have a second, Lynn?
Oh, you want to say something?
Thanks.
No, just quickly, the medical care event is in room 406, and right next door, because we are no dummies and we want to go there too, briefly at 6:30 will be the Socialist Caucus business meeting. So do join us there to plan for next year, and then we can go next door and hear Donna Smith.
I want to respond to Martin's comment also, or question. As I said, most people will not see any benefit. Most people will instead see continuing increases in cost and cost shifting, so that it will continue to cost employees more to get poorer insurance. Employer-based insurance is not changed by this plan. And you can see the lack of enthusiasm for the plan in the American public. Obama recognizes it in the quote that one of you read, that this plan doesn't do anything for people, and what we're doing is pointing that out and showing that there is an alternative and building the movement for the alternative.
In the back. So that's true, but the outcome is not predetermined. And in Vermont, we did have a very happy event this week, in that the Democrat running for governor, Peter Shumlin, ran on a very explicit single-payer platform, also an anti-nuclear power platform. And those interests did pour resources into that campaign. And there was a very clear right-wing Republican businessman guy who it was a very clear choice. Shumlin won. And the state legislature in Vermont is prepared to push forward with having Vermont begin a single-payer health program as soon as the federal government will permit it. So that is a very optimistic story, I can tell you. I can also tell you in Massachusetts, there was a ballot question on the ballot in only certain districts, and therefore it did not attract any attention from any opposition from the industry, and it was almost under the radar. It was a grassroots effort. All the usual suspects just got it onto the ballot in the towns and the legislative districts, and it passed by a landslide. It was between 60% and 85% it passed in each of the towns where it was on the ballot. It was a resolution affirming that healthcare is a human right and explicitly directing the state, the representatives of the district to support single-payer healthcare. It was very, very clear.
Cordy, we have a couple questions on this side first. Yeah, go ahead. Itself
sign her up.
Physicians as well.
Sign her up.
By not advocating for this healthcare reform, I think we really should pick up the blame, and it's not just the insurance companies.
I will just make one comment. If it's any reassurance, the majority of the American people want some form of national health insurance. So the American people know what's right. And in terms of the physicians, Physicians for National Health Program has been advocating passionately for what's right, which is single-payer national health insurance.
So has the American College of Physicians.
Right, and so has the American College of Physicians, and other physician groups have been very, very actively involved in this. And then you were next, and then Gordy. Well, if it's the only system there is, then there's nothing really to go to if you want to pull away. But go ahead.
It seems like a negative, like a, I never understand constructive.
I think it's very simple. It's all about the money. It's all about the reimbursement and the skewing of the profession, you know, away from primary care is only about the money. I mean, primary care is the most intrinsically rewarding specialty. So if you take away the disincentive, everyone will want to do it. And I want to say one more funny story about the idea of physicians. I'm also a delegate to the Massachusetts Medical Society, and we had a day-long conference on payment reform a couple weeks ago. And it was really the leadership of the medical society, which you would expect to be a little bit more conservative than even the membership. And we had the representatives of the government, the secretary of EOHHS, all day long talking about what's coming at us, what's coming down the pike, more pay for performance, ACOs, patient-centered medical home. No one knows how we're going to pay for it, but we're going to have to do it. At the end of the day, there was an evaluation session, and we do it using keypads, so we get instant results on the screen. And there was one question about whether you like these different things, and they had this throwaway item on it for single payer. Single payer wasn't discussed all day, mind you. It wasn't about that at all. But the result was, at the end of this day, by a landslide, everyone said they were more supportive of single payer at the end of that day than before, in the belly of the beast of the Mass Medical Society. So we all looked around the room at each other and just went, cool. So I think that combined with the happy events in Vermont, I mean, I'm just feeling like we're there. We've been doing this educational work for years. People know. It's just the politics now. It's not that people don't understand the reality. So we're very, very close, and we need more of us just to get out there and, you know, as Martha says, just say it out loud and just push it over the edge, because we're getting there.
Gordy. Pushing for the plan that he believed in, we just heard, he decided.
Jonathan, I guess.
Somebody asked what to do. To some extent, you're doing it. You're here, you're learning, you're seeing slides, you can get available slides from PhD, you can do your own presentations. You don't feel comfortable doing your own presentations, we'll help you get comfortable. We do that in this training. We're doing, what, 1,000 people we trained out in the last 3 or 4 years through PhD. There's 18,000 positions out there now, and others who signed up for positions for National Health Program. Use the resources on that website. So we have to educate, we have to activate people. You all have friends who feel the same way. You need to tell them about it and get them to. Every state in this country, just about, has a single-payer activist organization.
True.
I mean, just about. And there's chapters
of
all state of positions for National Health Program. You can join. And if you're not a joiner, send money. Send it to Healthcare for All Vermont. Write that down. Healthcare for All Vermont. Go to the website. Send them money. That's who the battle's going to be in the next 6 months to see if we can get a model that we can use for the rest of the nation. So don't, if you leave this room, if you don't commit yourself to taking some sort of action to improve your own education, to talk to others, or to just send money, then you're not doing what you ought to do. You've been good coming and educating yourself, but that will never be enough doing this part.
So we'll take three questions. One, two, and then three in the back in the green. So. Okay, and second. Go ahead.
I believe a single payer, though I admit I am an administrator.
We need administration.
Of the 50 or 60 national healthcare systems that outperform the U.S., only two of those are true single payer systems. So I'm wondering that if we overemphasize single payer as the only alternative, are we losing valuable opportunities for social benchmarking and policy transfer that could really provide knowledge and ideas that could really help us all towards our common goals?
Who would like to tackle that, Martha?
We have Medicare. It's an American model that works. We don't have any other models to use that have the political attractiveness of Medicare, which has 40 million people who are using it and love it and are already supported. I mean, that's our view of it.
Yes. Go ahead. Yeah.
But it provides us the opportunity to fight back.
It gives people a voice to fight back. That's right. Yeah. Martha?
When systems get single payer, you know, when countries get single payer systems or NHIs, NHSs, however you want to define them, that's not the end of the struggle. That's the next step of the struggle. To some extent, leveling the playing field so that people can get some more care than they were able to get. But that's a constant battle. Look what's going on in the UK right now. Ghastly kinds of stuff. And those folks need to and are organizing and fighting back.
And I'll just say, I'm actually Canadian. I live in Vancouver. And there's a big fight in Canada and some of the provinces around private for-profit delivery, the question of whether that's something that we should allow, and private for-profit financing, duplicative private insurance. Big fight. So as Martha says, it's an ongoing battle between those polarities. Yes. Sure.
That's really offensive.
What's the argument against it?
What's the argument against it? We're spending more on healthcare than any other country in the world by far. If we actually use the dollars in our current system to provide healthcare, everybody in this country could have, pick your car of choice, a DeLorean, a Jaguar, a Lexus, I don't know. What's the biggest, baddest car? We could have the biggest, baddest car for every person in the country. I don't think it's a VW, a Chevy versus a Lincoln. I just don't see it. And plus, there's the moral argument. No, nobody should be allowed to buy their way to the head of the queue or to better health care. Period, full stop. Sorry.
I'm pretty sure mine isn't a Volkswagen.
Sorry? And in every other rich capitalist country, there may be a little bit of that going on, but there are controls built into those systems so that the rich can't buy their way to the head of the queue, because that's simply, in healthcare, unacceptable.
It
would destroy the systems.
Right,
as well.
But I think that that's a point that needs to be expressed, because that is, I just know that in my community, that's a huge.
I think oftentimes the people that are talking about being able to buy their way to the front have no idea what that would actually cost.
Yeah.
They actually can't afford it. Those really rich people actually can't afford it. So.
And if you really think about healthcare, right, public service, you can't buy two votes when we vote. You can't buy, and your free pass on the road to get past other people just because you have more money. It's the public service that we provide for people. Everybody has the same access level,
no, because corporations buy many books. You can't buy your book. We have a system in Baltimore. If you pay $10 a month, you can take the express lane.
I guess you can't design systems around outliers. Supplemental private insurance only pays for what's not medically necessary hospital and physician services. You cannot buy private duplicative insurance.
Right, but you still are having people that have disposable income. Extra.
Well, it's not even extra. It's extra. It's things that aren't considered to be medically necessary. But I'd be happy to talk to you at length about Canada. Anybody who wants to hang around. It's 6:15. Many people are starving. So I want to thank you so much for coming.